Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we talk with former Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Joe Clark. Some background for listeners. Mr. Clark was born in High River, Alberta, the only Canadian Prime Minister born and raised in Prairie, Canada. A graduate of and lecturer at the University of Alberta, Mr. Clark was elected in his early 20s as national president of the Progressive Conservative Student Federation in the Diefenbaker era. He worked as a journalist and then as organizer and provincial election candidate for Alberta Premier Lougheed before coming to Ottawa as executive assistant to Robert Stanfield, who was then leader of the opposition in Ottawa. Mr. Clark was elected as a member of parliament for Rocky Mountain in 1972. He won the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party in 1976, becoming leader of the opposition. In 1979, he led his party to a minority victory, but was then defeated on a budget vote by Pierre Elliott Trudeau later in that year. He lost the Tory leadership to Brian Mulroney in 1983, but chose to remain in national affairs. When the Progressive Conservatives won in the 1984 election, Mr. Clark became Canada's foreign minister for 6 years, and later, Minister for Constitutional Affairs, securing unanimous federal, provincial, territorial, Indigenous agreement in the Charlottetown Accord. He retired from politics in 1993, serving as UN Special Envoy for Cyprus. He returned to lead the Progressive Conservatives from 1998 to 2003, serving first as MP for King's Haunt in Nova Scotia and then Calgary Centre. He retired from active politics in 2004. Since then, Mr. Clark remains active in public service and the private sector on the global stage. He is chair of the awards jury of the Global Center on Pluralism, an active member of the not-for-profit Global Leadership Foundation, which offers experienced advice of former leaders like himself to heads of government in developing countries. He is chair of the supervisory board of Meridian Infrastructure Africa, with major projects throughout the subcontinent. More about that later. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau appointed Mr. Clark to serve as special envoy in Canada's recent bid for a seat on the UN Security Council. Mr. Clark, you remain busy. Mr. Clark, thank you and welcome to Global Exchange.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with your sense of the world situation. We've got pandemic, America First, a rising China, revanchist Russia, we've got more attention to what's going on in the Indo-Pacific, Korea. I mean, the world is in turmoil. Is that a fair assumption? And from you've observed global situation now for almost half a century, perhaps even longer in many ways, is it just more complex and confused, or is this just the way it is?
It's much more divided than it was before. Those divisions are not only between nations. What is quite interesting about these times is that they are within nations. And that is not simply a phenomenon in the places we pay a lot of attention to, like Brexit, Britain, or the United States. It is quite literally a situation around the world. Even in places where one assumed that authoritarian leaders could have virtually free rein, there is substantial opposition in the streets. And it's important to recognize that this is internal, as well as it is between countries, because that makes the challenges of finding some kind of peace, finding some kind of reconciliation, even more important. I was interested the other day taking a look at the Carnegie Endowment website, who have a new piece on polarization in Thailand, in parts of Asia that we had, I think, assumed were, they were off our screen at what was happening. We were aware of what was happening in India, of course, but this is a global phenomenon, and it creates a very real uncertainty in the world. And in addition to all this, of course, there is the atmosphere of the pandemic, which shows no sign of abating and no sign of returning quickly to the kind of, I suppose one could almost say, relative comfort that we knew before.
Now, when you talked about the divisions internally, which I think, of course, is right, is Canada immune from this, or do we have to be on guard as well?
We're not immune to it. We have certain natural and historic advantages. We're a wealthy country. We have been remarkably successful in accommodating people who came from very different backgrounds. indeed welcoming them. And we've been able to do that in a very, very forthcoming way. We're naturally a country of differences, and our skill has been to recognize that others have interests too, and they have to be recognized. And we are, of course, subject to some of the challenges that exist in other parts of the world, not least because we're a multicultural nation, but because these kinds of tensions are not confined to one system. So no, we're not immune. We have to work at it. We can be tempted also to be inward-looking. I think that is happening now, that we are focusing too much on our own problems and are not paying enough attention to the nature and the extent of international problems. I don't want to exaggerate what Canada can do, but I certainly don't want to suggest that we are immune from influence. On the contrary, we have some very real opportunities to affect change in the world.
In preparing for this talk with you, I went back and looked at the book you wrote. It's almost a decade now, How We Lead Canada in a Century of Change. And I do think it stands up well. And you make some of the points you just made, but you also argue that Canada, I thought interesting phrase, lead from beside, and you warned against, I do think this has still application, lecturing and leaving. If you were to revise the book, what other advice would you give to Canadian policymakers?
Well, I think those aspects remain. I think what has happened in the last little while is that we and the world have naturally become more focused upon economic and security interests. And there is no question that those are important. But there's also no question that other elements of traditional Canadian policy, I'm not defending them because they're traditional. I'm defending them first because they spring from our nature, and secondly, because they have had some effect in the past. I think we need to pay more attention to those. We are situated next to one of the world's superpowers, the United States. Our traditional economic relations and a lot of our traditional cultural relations were with Europe. We have had relations with the larger world, of course, but we have tended to be, I think, too focused upon some of our traditional relationships and traditional means of proceeding. And I think we have to take a much wider look at what we can do internationally in the world. And we have to do it, to go back to a phrase that you used, not by preaching, but by taking account of what real interests are of other countries and trying to determine where we can have some influence upon them.
My observation is that you are a multilateralist and you think that it works. I believe that as well. When you talk about Canada taking a broader interest, do we do it through multilateral institutions or do we get involved on a bilateral basis or is it kind of a blend?
I think it has to be a blend, but I think that the decline has been in the support for multilateralism. And that's because there is, on the one hand, a natural tendency in a time of troubles to hunker down. And on the other hand, because these are complicated arrangements and they do not always pay off in the sorts of things I could have taken to my constituents in Rocky Mountain or Yellowhead in the time that I was in the House of Commons. But these rules are particularly, they're necessary now generally, but we have, if I may say so, we have a particular talent in these fields. We were talking earlier about whether Canada is immune from some of the tensions that are roiling other countries. We're not immune, but we are recognized as having capacities for reconciliation that other countries don't. And I think that is part of our history. We were a country which welcomed anyone, and while there were obvious inequalities, still are, people were able to proceed on their merit rather than because of their station. And we are in a position where we're trusted more than other countries in the world might be. We're trusted to respect others' interests as well as our own. I think those are talents and requirements now that require more attention than they're receiving.
Now, I mentioned earlier you were Minister of Constitutional Affairs. You had to deal with provinces and territories. Do you think that but you'd come from being foreign minister, you know, often you think of sort of bottoms up, but you sort of went at it from foreign minister to then managing the Federation. And as we said earlier, this is a challenge. Did managing the Federation, does make us more effective diplomats, especially in the multilateral forum? Because in a sense, we're doing multilateralism at home. We have to make Canada work.
Yeah, one way of looking at our Federation is that federalism is multilateralism. We have had to put up with differences and we have had to reconcile them. And now we've done that in the most favorable of circumstances. We've been spared from war by and large. We've been spared from the acute poverty and divisions that occur elsewhere. But nonetheless, it has been a constant challenge to try to make this work. And it isn't easy. I can pride myself on having secured a unanimous agreement as constitutional minister, but I'm very much aware that when it went to referendum, we were very solidly defeated. So I have to say also, Colin, that despite the extraordinary opportunities that I had as foreign minister, I think the portion of my life that was most challenging to me, and in a sense satisfying as we moved along, was in that constitutional sphere. And one of the things I learned from it is that there is no substitute for being able to sit down and talk to people actually, face to face, get some understand, not just talk to them. The important part is to listen to them and to get some understanding of as to what is going on. That has also, as you know very well, been an essential part of effective diplomacy. And it is much more difficult now in a modern, connected, media-centered world to have that kind of that capacity. But the determination to try to seek it, the determination to respect other people's interests, to take them seriously, the determination to listen is still a fundamental part of what we do. And not only are we good at it because we've learned at home, because we're lucky in our origins, but we have that kind of reputation. You mentioned that I'm a member of the organization, the Global Leadership Foundation. And without going into details, because we try to respect certain confidentiality on that matter, I was in Africa some years ago dealing with a country that was undertaking a difficult change. And they were interested in our services. But the question came down as to what would be the country of origin of the leaders whom we sent to try to help them address their problems, their particular challenge. And I was told that they would not welcome a former colonial power, which was a lot of Europe. They would not welcome the USA. I said, and how about Canada? And they said, well, we'd accept Canada. We'd prefer Indonesia, which was bracing to me and interesting, but I think also reflects that in a world of multiple histories, we have a respect as a country that is developed but is respectful of, understanding of, open to countries that have not had that tradition. I think that's a very important asset to us. And to go to your question as to whether we are divided at home, what impact that might have upon our effectiveness internationally, there are tendencies in all countries to have us sort of shut down, to have us draw inward. And I think we and the world have to resist that as much as we can.
Are you seeing signs? I mean, you mentioned earlier that I think there was a natural reaction by all nations in the first wave of the pandemic to kind of draw inwards. And we, like turtles, we close our borders and we basically look after ourselves because we're dealing with something that we've not had any experience with for a century. And the memory and the preparation was clearly not as good as we thought we would be. But do you think there's a danger that persists, my sense is we probably have to open up again if we're going to deal with this on a global basis. But what we've been seeing, certainly in the pandemic, is basically national efforts. And is that in part because the international leadership that we may have wanted isn't there, in part because the U.S. has, as Mr. Trump has put, America first?
Well, the U.S. situation has certainly had an impact upon multilateralism. That's true. The other thing that's true, and again, you and I have had the opportunity to see this up close, is that while international organizations and cooperation are very strong in principle and in aspiration, their performance is not always what it should be. And they, like other organizations, like internal organizations, grow old or become very habit-formed and limited by that. And part of the renewal, we can't treat Canada's multilateral talent as simply something historic. We were effective in the post-war era in the world because of the freshness that we brought. And we brought it in a context of being able to work with others. We need that kind of freshness now. We can't assume that the multilateral system as it works now is adequate. It has to be changed. Attitudes toward it have to be changed. Those changes have to come from people who believe fundamentally in that element of cooperation. And we've proven our credentials on that. And we're, by and large, respected on that. A lot of other countries are too. But we are in that position. And I think there does need to be a renewal within Canada of an interest in what we can do on a multilateral level. May I go off on a tangent here, just because it's been of interest to me for some time. I was a member of parliament from a rural area for a long, long time, an area with very strong service clubs. I remember going back 8 or 9 years ago now to a district meeting of Rotary International. And like a lot of people, when I speak at places, I tend to fly in and fly out. This was in northwestern Alberta. I couldn't fly out. So I had to take a look at the display of what clubs, Rotary clubs in that district had been doing internationally. I was blown away by it. And what's interesting about this is that many of these are Canadians in communities that one might regard as cautious about internationalism, as looking inward. But if that's their reputation, it's not their practice when they have an opportunity. So there's an instinct for that kind of role on the part of Canadians across the country. And governments, including people who had our experience in earlier times, have to be alive to ways in which we can take account of those current realities and ask ourselves, how do we apply that now?
That's very interesting. Do you think that's because, is that particular to Canada, or is that something that you've observed or observed through others elsewhere, but we're simply not taking advantage of it? That sort of sense of the wider world in what you might otherwise consider as backwaters.
I think that there is a degree to which, I think the short answer is, it's a Canadian attribute. And it's an attribute in part that is a product of our being relatively wealthy, and also our practice of being relatively equal, working with other people. Communities work together here by and large. They're under some strain now, strains of different kinds. But our tradition of being able to draw differences together is stronger than elsewhere in the world. We're not the only ones with it. The other factor we have, if I may say so, is a certain national modesty. We're comparable to our neighbor, the United States, in a lot of ways, but not in terms of modesty. Their whole strength, part of their strength as a country, was their sense that they were unique and they were going to be natural leaders. And in many cases, they have been. They've been, in many cases, very, very constructive. But they are not as open to others in their nature and their history as we have been. And that's a distinction for us that we shouldn't walk around and vaunt, but of which we have to take account when we're forming plans as to how our country, our point of view, can be effective in a very challenged world.
The United States, you've personally dealt with presidents and their administrations since Jimmy Carter. What did you learn in dealing with Uncle Sam? And are there some lessons that you've kind of learned and said, well, you know, we could apply this and this? You know, you talked about some of the other things we could do, leading from beside and things, which I think also applies in part to the U.S. But I'm interested because you've had a lot of experience. In fact, my first time I met you was in New York. You were down speaking at the Center for the Presidency, and I think it was Gordon Hoxie. And I always admired that you took this greater interest in the wider world, particularly the United States. So what about the U.S.? You've been watching it for a long time.
One of the characteristics, first of all, the U.S. is looking very inward. It has always been self-confident. It has never been as insistently inward as it is under President Trump. It's an open question as to whether he drew that out, whether he's caused it, whether both are the case. But it is certainly a characteristic now. And what has happened, I think, is that the more generous instincts of America as a whole have suffered from that. And it's going to be a long, hard resuscitation. It won't happen very quickly. And when one thinks about it, given our relatively good neighbor relations over so long a time, I think that no country apart from the USA is going to suffer more from that hardening of attitudes towards others than Canada will. Because we have, when you look at it, and you know this as well as I, we have been the beneficiaries of, we've had the benefit of the doubt from Americans on fairly critical questions. I can recall some to mind in the free trade agreement. There was a major issue about Canadian culture. The Americans just couldn't understand that. And then you'll recall George Shultz, who said in one of those meetings, okay, I get it, but we consider entertainment, you consider culture. Don't understand that, but we understand it's your position. And so we were able to move forward with that in the free trade agreement. Again, in the Arctic, when there was a challenge of the polar sea voyage, very real differences of view and of interest came up in that conflict. And we were able, we, Canada, the United States, we received the benefit of the doubt. We were able to work out a modus vivendi, a way of working together that allowed us to continue. President Trump took a shot at it the other couple of months ago, but apparently has backed off. But nonetheless, that was a fairly consistent aspect of our nature with the United States for some time. And I don't think we are going to see much of that again, because it was sort of deep in the bone of Canadian-American practice. And now it has been changed. And attitudes toward the rest of the world, attitudes towards allies have changed. And a change of regime may bring some specific alteration to that. But I think that we are going to have to recognize that while we have an economic and a geographic relationship with the United States that is critical to us, we also have to begin to look beyond that relationship and to build on our other assets. Some of them are economic, some of them are not. They simply are going to have to be, we have to take a broader look as to where and with whom we can have influence in changing the contemporary challenges that the world is facing.
Okay, well, let's look at the other big power out there, the rising China, that we had wanted to have a relationship with, and I think you were foreign minister during Tiananmen Square. So there's you've seen China, you know, the opportunity, but you also see that there can be a darker side. And now we're sort of increasingly portraying it as a kind of strategic adversary and some say systemic rival. Is the best we can hope for kind of a peaceful coexistence? You had to deal with it in an immediate sense back in, as they say, 89, but you've been seeing things since then as well.
What was interesting in Tiananmen, and I remember in the House of Commons, but I remember most of all when we heard the news of Tiananmen, was the tears in the eyes of colleagues of mine on all sides of the House of Commons, because there had been, not among everyone, but there had been in all parties, a sense that we were making some progress on that issue. And then Tiananmen broke that. And we did two things then. We brought together the legitimate interests of Canadians concerned about China, all the way from people who were relatives of the kids in the square to chambers of commerce and others. And we worked out a very robust and quite durable response to Tiananmen. But we also, from sort of that point onward, went on to try to find areas where our interests could be shared. And we worked on those. And that had some success, along with the initiatives of other governments. That had some success in establishing relationship that encouraged a lot of us for a long time. That is now suspended. And we have to be realistic that the nature of Canada's relation with China has changed profoundly. That doesn't mean we can simply condemn them or walk away. We can't. We have to find areas where our interests can converge. And very often, as was the case in the post-Tiananmen situation, those are going to be small convergences that could grow into something larger. But the sense that we can simply reject China, we can pretend it isn't there, that we can take a determinedly adversarial relationship to it, that's very counterproductive. What's happening, I think, is that we are going to have to contemplate that our hope that China would adapt to our system is now in doubt. And we have to begin to base our relationship on the sense that there are, in fact, fundamentally different systems which have common interests, and find and look for ways in which we can pursue those common interests.
And if you were to identify some areas which you think there is common interest, in part based on that earlier experience?
There aren't many right now. This is a very difficult time. There may be some, because our range of contacts is larger than it was on diplomatic levels. Until there has been some movement on the two Davids, it's going to be very difficult for us to take any kind of initiatives. But we nonetheless have to sit down and try to identify areas where there is possible convergence. We have to look for ways where our interests are common, are shared, rather than seek to put them apart. I'm sorry I can't be more precise on this. I'd like to be. I'm not in the field anymore. I'm not the expert that I once pretended to be. But I think that has to be the state of mind. And we cannot allow a suspicious, antagonistic state of mind to dominate our relation with that or indeed any country.
The two Michaels, though, in a sense, have become the litmus test from a Canadian perspective. And from a Chinese perspective, they kind of look at Meng Wanzhou. Some have suggested that we try and work something out. Do you have a view on that, or that's not where you want to go?
I would be very skeptical about a swap. I'm skeptical about that kind of bargain. I think there has to be some movement on the merits of one case or the other. I would not want to create the precedent that a swap of some kind would establish. It's a hard time. What we have to do is look for areas where there might be possible convergence.
All right. You've devoted a lot of your personal attention, in part through the Global Leadership Foundation, to Africa. Africa doesn't get a lot of attention in Canada from Canadians. So I guess I put the sort of question to you, should Canadians care about Africa and why?
Yeah, we certainly should care about Africa. I mean, there's some simple statistics. One is that before COVID, Africa was the fastest growing economic entity in the continent in the world. It really has enormous potential. The second is its population. An enormous proportion of Africans, I have to check my notes, are under the age of 25. I mean, it is far and away the youngest, and in some cases it has been the fastest growing continent. We can't ignore that. And it's not all traditional African fare. It's very... It's becoming a very sophisticated continent in very many ways. Also, it's a continent whose citizens, as Europe is learning, can move. And there's no confining status quo that is going to cause Africa to become less prominent. And we have, to go to the positive side, we have unusually strong historic connections with Africa. If you look back at it, when we started a serious international development program, some 60% of what CETA was doing in the early days was in Africa, and it stayed that way for a long time. If you look at our involvement in some of the serious political challenges of Africa, where as other Western countries tended to be cautious, we took a very forward-looking position anti-apartheid campaign. Our relations through our fraternal organizations, like Francophonie and the Commonwealth, are very strong. They're families of a kind. And so we have all of these attributes in common. There is a substantial Canadian economic presence there in Africa. It needs to be extended. But I think we have to be very realistic. We have to be hard-headed. But I think that we have to pay relatively more attention to how we can not rely on, but renew our tradition of engagement in Africa. We are trusted there more than other countries are. And the we in this case is not simply governments, it is the country. We are relatively well guarded there. So I think that, and I'm not speaking here about some kind of massive shift, but I think that we have to be paying a lot more attention to Africa. I was back in Southern Africa, as you would know, in our campaign for the Security Council seat. I was impressed by the degree to which Canada's historic reputation is still alive in significant parts of Africa. That's not an asset we should waste.
And certainly, you know, you get the impression that, as with Asia, official visits really do matter, and the educational ties in Asia, going back to Colombo Plan, but also with Africans coming to Canadian universities, this was a great asset that governments consistently did invest in, but not so much in the last decade. And, you know, this is not just a conservative, this is also a liberal. There were kind of a shift. My presumption would be that you would think that that was a mistake on our part, that we really should go back into this. Part of it became the economics, but as you pointed out, the economics actually for potential for Africa are pretty high.
They could be substantially high. Yeah, I think that it wasn't that we sort of turned away from Africa so much as we turned toward other things. And all I'm saying is that we have to take a much broader view of where our opportunities are based upon the reputation we've earned, the relationships that we've established in the past. And I don't mean at all to suggest that nothing is being done. I am concerned that we are focusing too narrowly on economic issues, too narrowly upon security issues, and not enough upon some of the, I guess, call them political issues, the issues of getting along with difference, the issues of reconciliation, as we have traditionally, and for which we have a reputation. But we also have a capacity to advance that, as a few other countries do, but we are in a fairly limited range of countries who could do that. And in my view, we're not doing it enough.
And part of that comes down, I guess, to foreign service and investing in your diplomatic service. My sense was that it was something you personally cared about. Are we taking full advantage of our foreign service and investing in it as we should?
I think we're not. I came very much as a newcomer to the foreign service when I became minister. I had the opportunity to learn its immense strength. I still have to do with a number of our foreign service officers, and am impressed by them. I think that their status in the Ottawa firmament has declined, and that is unfortunate for the country. I think that our budgetary restrictions are difficult. I think that the focus upon trade, while I understand it, has meant that we do not have as much latitude or as reach as we could have, given the nature of our country. So I would like to see. You may recall that after the 1988 election, as minister, and Cy Taylor was my deputy, we decided that we were going to have an in-house discussion of senior officials of the department as to where we should be looking. And we did. We went, not accidentally, to my constituency of Jasper, where there happened to be a lovely hotel at that time of the year. And we had that kind of a very direct discussion among, I admit, the leadership of the department. One of the things that was most interesting was that there was a session on the Soviet Union. Cy Taylor had an experience in that field that was quite deep. But I recall when he introduced the panel that was discussing it, he said, "These people are going to say things with which I disagree, but we all have to hear and listen to them." And that engendered a very rich discussion on that question. But it also established a tone, or maintained a tone, I think, that I like to believe was prevalent in the department at the time. Now, it was easier then. I was the last foreign minister with a budget who could undertake initiatives on things that might or might not prove possible. But it was also the consequences of that open discussion, drawing upon the best informed judgment of foreign service officers, were very significant. And they brought out the best in the department. They brought the best of the country into the department. That has to happen again.
And if I go back to where we began, it's that kind of investment, given the kind of country we are, that probably is our niche, but we have to recognize it and then invest in it accordingly, as you did, and as you and Mr. Mulroney proved with things like the unification of Germany, and as you described, the work against sort of prevailing odds, Britain and the United States, in terms of apartheid in South Africa. And yet you managed and maintained good relations, certainly with the United Kingdom and the United States, even if on occasion, I think sometimes, well, certainly Mrs. Thatcher wasn't always pleased, but certainly appeared to have respect for what we were trying to do. So we can do this if we are prepared to, and if we're prepared to invest in it, because we have capacity.
Yeah, and we were respected because of who we are as a country. I haven't read the book yet. I noticed a review the other day on a book about France called Napoleon and de Gaulle. And there was a very interesting quote in it. It says, quote, "The influence of France has more to do with what France represents than what it is." And that's historic. That has to do with language. It has to do with culture. It has to do with whatever France is. Well, that's certainly true of France, but it's also true of us. So we have to ask ourselves, what does Canada represent? What are our qualities that distinguish us from other countries? Not to say we're different, but to identify areas where we can have more effect upon events, wherever they are, than other countries must. And in fact, one could start a little list. I won't do it today, but it might be a good thing to do, to draw up a little list of those things. But what we represent is not only real in Canada, it's fairly well regarded in the world. We're not as prominent in anyone's eyes as the French are, but I think there is a recognition that we have an identity as a distinct nation that opens doors for us and roles for us in the wider world.
An observation I'd make, and I'd be interested if you'd agree with it, is that in many ways, Canadians' own sense of identity as to what we are as Canadians comes from a perception of what we're doing abroad, because we really are the people of the world, thanks to immigration, which is, again, broadly shared across partisan grounds. We continue, but we take a sense of ourselves from how we're seen abroad and what we're doing abroad. Is that fair?
Yes, and because we are connected abroad. And, you know, we came from abroad as our indigenous people lined us all. And that connection has been renewed through time, particularly, I think, in the post-war era. But it's very significant now. And without exaggerating it, without diminishing the other factors we have to deal with, it is a very important element of what we can become in a world that very much needs the all-in leadership of all countries. We have, without preaching, without pretending that we're a house on a hill somewhere, we nonetheless have the capacity to both understand others and cause others to understand themselves and the world to a greater degree than many countries do, and to help them actually achieve common goals. So I think there need to be discussions about Canadian international purpose that go beyond simple specific issues or the relations with which we've become comfortable or into which have been the result of our recent focus. And I think that's an obligation on the part of Canada. I also think it's a very real opportunity for us, which we need, because the countries upon which we have traditionally relied most, Europe and the United States, are now far more self-occupied than they were before. We're going to remain friends, we're going to remain active in their orbit, but we are going to have to expand our reach. And that's not just an aspiration, that's a possibility. It's within our capacity to do that. I hope we can, and I very much hope we can do that. We can begin.
I'm going to put a last question to you. We said at the outset, you came from Prairie Canada. You know the importance out there of agri-food, energy, our resources. Now, of course, there's some challenge about, can we manage all this at the same time dealing with issues like climate? Can we take advantage of these, what some have referred to as our kind of heritage, our natural crown jewels, but at the same time manage a renewable, sustainable Canada at the same time? Again, you know this, you grew up with this, but you've also had to deal with the bigger issue, and you've seen it around the world, the challenge that climate presents.
My short answer to that is yes, we can. And in fact, a lot of the activity, for example, on renewables is being driven by Alberta-based, Western Canada-based companies. The issue is whether Canadian leaders are prepared to sit down and discuss reasonably one with the other as to where there is common ground. And again, we began this by mentioning my constitutional role. What I learned most about that was that if one kept at it long enough, one could get agreement across the most remarkable distances among people who came into a room, came into that process with radically different views on priorities and on the possible. And because they sat in a room with one another and listened to one another and came to listen, not to sell, we were able to get agreement. And while that happened in a dramatic instance in Charlottetown, that has happened quite remarkably over time in Canada. I think that there is a temptation in various reasons to look narrowly rather than broadly. But I think that given the opportunity, leaders will rise to the opportunities of Brent.
I thank you, because I think that perseverance that you demonstrated and those listening skills, which you demonstrate particularly now through the Global Leadership Foundation, are in a sense essential to good diplomacy, and especially from a Canadian perspective, because we do not always have the weight in things. But if we can listen and persevere, as you demonstrate personally, I think that's not a bad way to, and have ideas. I guess that's the third piece, is that you certainly have ideas. That's effective diplomacy. So.
Well, but that has been the Canadian diplomatic tradition at its best. I was lucky to have been dropped in at the top and to be able to learn a lot from it. But part of what made us effective was that we were building upon precisely that tradition, and we need to renew that. Great department, too, if you will recall.
Yes. No, I think that's absolutely right. My last question now is, what are you reading these days? You mentioned that looking at a book on Napoleon and de Gaulle. What else are you reading?
I want to be clear, I've not read that. It's called Napoleon and de Gaulle and something else,
okay,
but it's on my list. What I'm reading now, and it's very interesting to me because I know not enough about it, is a book called Black Wave by Kim Gattas. And it is about, in effect, the relations over the last 40, 45 years between Saudi Arabia and Iran and others in the region, and how that has affected the divisions that we're now seeing in the Middle East. She is a journalist, a skilled journalist, Lebanese of origin. So her writing is lively, but her insight is also remarkable. I'm enjoying it a lot. I'm learning a lot. Things that circumstances into which I had been thrust, I won't say they necessarily make more sense, but I understand them better in retrospect from going through Black Wave by Kim Gattas.
All right, there we have it, Black Wave listeners. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by the Right Honorable Joe Clark, former Prime Minister of Canada. Remember, you can find the CJA Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Charlotte Duval-Antoine and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.